Last night, Ajahn Vasna was talking about feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling, and particularly in its relationship to concentration and development of samadhi and different aspects of that. And I was also considering how, when I was in India on my sabbatical, and then people have asked about it since then, when reflecting on the kind of focus that I had for the meditation while I was there during that year, what I've most commonly said, or what I found I was most intent on, focusing upon at the time, was also the meditation on feeling. A very extended, slightly multifaceted contemplation, but also basically focusing on feeling and contemplating the world of feeling. Now, the aspect that say Ajahn Pasna was talking about is commonly the way that the Buddha spoke about Vedana. The definition of Vedana or feeling is mostly confined to the realm of sensation. A kind of basic apprehension of a kind of pleasant, painful, or neutral nature. And so the way we use the word feeling in English is slightly loose. And so when I was thinking of my own practice or the focus that I had last year, it was related but slightly slightly different in some ways. The Buddha's teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness, the very core framework for his teaching and a way of casting his own insight and conveying that to people. And you know, those four foundations, or the four different dimensions of mindfulness, the four domains where mindfulness needs to be developed, firstly that of the body, kaya anupassana, then secondly vedana, feeling, vedana anupassana, and the third one is called citta anupassana, which citta literally means heart or mind, and then the citta anupassana, and then the fourth one is dhamma anupassana, which is variously translated as mindfulness of mind objects, investigation of mind objects, or investigation in terms of Dhamma. So you can either render it with a small d or a big d, yeah. And of course debates have simmered, raged, over the past couple of thousand years on exactly what the Buddha meant when he said Dhamma Nupassana. But anyway, also because of the Upasika Day tomorrow that we have scheduled, and I believe citta anupassana is the theme, is that correct?
Yes. One more.
So, coincidentally, so I thought I would reflect on that domain, particularly of citta anupassana, because that was really the main interest or where my attention was centered during that sabbatical year, citta anupassana. In the classical exposition on this, what's called the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the great discourse on the foundations of mindfulness or the frames of reference. When the Buddha was describing citta anupassana, mindfulness of the mind or mind states, there's this a long succession of different examples that he gives to illustrate what he means by that term. So he defines that kind of mindfulness as when the person is contemplating citta anupassana, when one's cultivating citta anupassana, then that person knows the concentrated mind is concentrated, or the unconcentrated mind is unconcentrated. Knowing the angry mind is angry, the mind free from anger is free from anger. Knowing the expanded mind is expanded, the contracted mind is contracted. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, the unagitated mind is unagitated, and so on and so forth. So one of the most significant things about that, as you'll probably have noticed, is that mindfulness doesn't mean that the mind is completely free of unwholesome states. That, you say, agitation, contractedness, anger, these all sound like things that are unskillful, unhelpful. They're going to sound like obstructive mind states. But in this teaching, the Buddha points out the key element is a mindfulness, a clear, unbiased knowing of those states. And this is the element that liberates. This is the factor that frees the heart, that is, in a way, brings us to a clarity and a peacefulness, consummates the spiritual efforts, is that quality of mindfulness. And then with the other elements of the other three elements of the foundations of mindfulness and all the different subdivisions, the Buddha defines that quality of mindfulness as knowing these states as they arise, knowing them as they disappear, knowing them to the extent simply that there is this. This is the state that is present. Yeah, and this is what is sufficient to establish the quality of sati, of mindfulness, of a wholehearted attention, a full attention. And at the beginning of the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says the oft quoted passage of this is the render it as the only way to deliverance. Others say that render it as there is this one path, this ekayana magga, this a path going in one direction only. But however one renders it, it's the sense of it, that the overall meaning is that this is the track to get on. This is the way. This is the, if there isn't this involved in what you're doing spiritually, then it's just not going to arrive at peacefulness, at liberation. It's just it's a sine qua non of liberation, of spiritual fulfillment, of true peacefulness. So he says that at the beginning of the discourse. At the end of the discourse, he says that someone who has developed these four foundations of mindfulness and sustains mindfulness for a certain period of time, he guarantees their liberation. And then he starts off by saying, if you did this for 7 years, then you're bound to be liberated. And 7 years, 6 years, 5 years, 4 years. It's like one of these children's songs. He kind of has this familiar way of cascading down the numbers. 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, not even 1 year, 6 months, not even 6 months, 6 weeks, not even 6 weeks, 1 month, not even a month, 2 weeks, not even 2 weeks, 7 days. 7 days, if one simply maintains this quality of sati, of mindfulness, wholehearted attention to these different domains of experience, then he guarantees that person will either realize complete liberation or one of the higher levels of enlightenment, just short of complete liberation. So this is high praise indeed, and a major sort of emphatic statement. Pointing to the importance, the crucial quality of this kind of ability, this capacity that we have to be mindful, to know fully and completely, clearly, the nature of our experience. I didn't really have a particular plan or a focus, an intended focus for practice last year. I was quite resolute, in fact, in just letting things shape themselves. The one assertion, the one determination I did make before I left for that year was to take the advice that Master Xuanhua gave to one of the monks of our community. And Master Hua was the monk who was the late abbot of City of 10,000 Buddhas, founder of that monastery and many others. And in 1989, he happened to be visiting our monastery in England. And during a fairly informal get-together one day with the nuns and monks in one of the meditation halls, people were just asking questions and he was offering responses and reflections. One of the monks who was about to embark on a six-month journey to India to walk around all of the different Buddhist holy places and like a thousand-mile pilgrimage on foot was what he was planning. Master Hua didn't know this, at least as far as we know, no one had told him. But when this monk, Ajahn Sujito, asked him a question about some sort of technicality about samadhi practice and concentration, Master Hua apparently completely ignored his question, although he might have just been answering a little obliquely. And what he said was, "When you go to practice in the place of the Buddha, do not find fault with anyone or anything. When you go to practice in the place of the Buddha, do not find fault with anyone or anything." So, especially since Ajahn Sujito hadn't said, "I'm going off to India next year to the Buddhist holy places, what would be your advice?" But asked something utterly different. The fact that this came out of the blue and was handed to him, he thought, this is obviously a very significant message. So he took that to heart, and that advice literally saved his neck in India when he was in many different occasions and situations, but particularly when he was confronted with a group of half a dozen bandits with axes and wooden staves who were about to put one of them through his head. He remembered this, "Oh yes, do not find fault, even if this guy's holding an axe over your head and threatening to bring it down, attempting to bring it down, don't find fault with him." And so that the fact that he did survive that, and very well, had a deep impact on me and many of the other members of the community. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to take one piece of advice with me to India, I'll take that. Because also knowing that it's easy to get frustrated and annoyed, critical with the other people that you encounter or institutions or systems that are doing things that you don't want them to do. You know, the trains that don't show up on time, or the trains that do show up on time and then don't move for 12 hours while you're sitting on them. Or just knowing I was going to be with one or two traveling companions in very close quarters for months on end, I realized, yeah, these are situations where it's very easy to contend, to find fault with others, and to blame, to criticize, to grumble, to moan. Just taking that simple piece of advice, I took that as a something of a basis of practice for the year. Well, anyway, somewhere along the line, I think probably when I was, it was during the rains retreat, and I was doing a great deal of formal practice every day. And during that time, I found that I was really focusing on Jhetanupassana and contemplating feeling, you know, pleasant feelings, painful feelings, neutral feelings, and as a sort of raw experience, but then also the attitudes, the moods that contributed to those. So Jhetanupassana tends to be more, when we talk about that, it's a sort of more emotionally colorful or conceptually involved. So they'd be like referring to a mood or a train of thought or mental activity. Vedana tends to be sort of the distilled down root feeling that comes from that. So, you know, Vedana is sort of non-verbal and not coloured by different shades of emotion. It's a sort of like, dislike, or neutral. This is one way of regarding it, but this is how I tend to frame it for myself. So I found that during this time, with a lot of formal practice, also it was a very simple living situation. The days were extraordinarily repetitive, very, very simple, very little contact with other people. And so there was a very plain backdrop against which to view the activities, the habits of mind, the projections of the mind. And so I found that the attention focusing very closely in on moods and feelings, and it was a very transformative time. I don't think I quite see the world internally or externally in the same way anymore. It really it was a very radical shift of perspective during that time. Because I found that, you know, even though I've been practicing meditation for many, many years, and you train yourself to look at the flow of thoughts and feelings and perceptions, to recognize them as empty, as being transient, uncertain, as not who and what we are. Even though we do a lot of that, you know, all the time, this is sort of the bread and butter of our, or the rice and tofu of our meditation practice. This is there's always a few things that slip through. Isn't that right? That certain things we see as kind of clearly, obviously, oh, this is a reaction, this is a feeling, this is an opinion. Empty, not self, boom, and then we let go of it. But then other things creep in and get believed. And so what I began to notice was that, say, even though, say for example, I would be, say, sitting there one day and there would be an irritated, a negative thought would cross my mind, you know, complaining about the mosquitoes biting me or the way that one of my traveling companions was doing something, some sort of annoying habit. And I would see that, say, oh, well, here's a feeling of irritation, the mind is creating this person and creating a negative thought about them. Oh, this is just a thought, let it go. So we see that kind of thing, we can see that fairly straightforwardly maybe. But then the thought of, I'm really a kind of narrow-minded, selfish person, you know, I'm still having these kind of critical thoughts about people who are really trying to help me, you know, I'm really a bit of a pathetic character. Yeah, I really ought to be doing a lot better than this after 25 years in the game. So that kind of, that's what the sort of thing that sneaks in the back door and gets makes itself at home. Meanwhile, out in the front room, you're saying, you know, oh, this is an empty. This feeling of irritation is empty and insubstantial. The sort of meta with one T, the meta attitude and thought, kind of comes in and parks itself and gets believed in completely. And so I began to focus on that, those kind of meta thoughts and attitudes, and that the sort of whole second layer, third layer of ideas, moods, feelings, the sort of undercurrent of self-criticism. Yeah, I'm really a bit of a fraud, you know, after all these years. People think I'm really something great, but actually I'm really a kind of a lazy wimp. But, you know, but I'm good at faking it. And these kind of things that we just go on in our minds, and it just was shocking to see, wow, those get believed all the time. They just sort of come in, and because your attention is so busy with the first, you know, the top layer, those undercurrents of attitudes about ourselves, about other people close to us, about the world around us, we are unaware of how solid we make those. So I began to quite deliberately flag all of those attitudes and sub-attitudes, sub-sub-attitudes and feelings, moods, and to notice them. Well, that too is actually just a feeling. That, oh dear, I've been doing this for so long, I really ought to be better than this by now. This is the, oh dear, I've been doing this for so long, I really ought to be better than this by now feeling. This is the, hey, and then when you're sitting there and being really inspired, oh, this is really great, my practice is really coming together, this is marvelous, hey, this is great. This is the, oh look, my practice is really coming together, this is really great feeling. And, you know, these are kind of rather long strings of words to to define each of these particular patterns. But what was found by taking the trouble to pay attention to those, to the citta, the activities of the heart on the on those levels, you know, the metta feelings, the metta metta feelings, the metta 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 feelings, however many layers it goes back, to keep flagging that and to seeing that, you know, the levels at which, you know, attitudes, ideas, moods are being believed in, they're being solidified by our careless attention, by unmindfulness. Then to say, oh, this too is just a feeling. This is a negative feeling. This is a neutral feeling. This is a positive feeling. It's just this. And then seeing how, in the Buddha's description of cittanupassana, knowing the angry mind is angry, you know, the mind free from anger is free from anger, the contracted mind, the expanded mind. You say, oh, this is exactly what he was talking about. It's not just what's on the surface, it's however deeply down it goes, just to track it at every level. You know, to the point where, say, whether, you know, maybe you see something and say, oh, you know, some really deeply rooted attitude, like, I'm a fundamentally lazy person, I'll probably never get liberated in this lifetime anyway, oh well. And seeing, well, that's just the, I'm really lazy, this is, I'm never going to get liberated in this lifetime, oh well, feeling. And then following that, there's the thought, hey, this is, and then you realize, well, that's just that feeling. Then you realize, hey, this is really great, maybe this is the way around that whole thing, maybe it, maybe I can, you know, sneak around that whole mass of complication, and hey, this looks like a really easy way out. Well, that's the hey, this looks like a really really easy way out feeling. So I can't emphasize too much how valuable I found this to be. I mean, it takes a lot of effort. You need to be pretty thorough and quick on the spiritual feet, as it were, because it's very slippery. You know, how easily the mind, you know, creates those formations, mental formations, ideas, moods, attitudes. It's extraordinarily slippery. But it's also extraordinarily effective in breaking up those barriers that we've placed around the heart, all the seemingly immovable perceptions of who and what we are. I am this person, you know, I have these individual qualities, I have this personal history, I have these good attributes, these bad attributes, these neutral attributes, these are the kinds of things I'm praised for, these are the kinds of things I'm criticized for, this is what I like about myself, this is what I don't like about myself. You know, how solidly we create those. And even though on one level, as I said, you know, with insight meditation in particular, we can focus upon those domains that we can easily see through, the very thinly transparent perceptions. But it's these other more densely clouded and heavily encrusted areas where, you know, we need to, you know, look very, very closely and crank up the light source to see, well, these two, these are transparent too. That, Well, I have great confidence in the practice, but I really don't want to meet any psychic people because they might be able to see something going on in my mind that I'm going to be embarrassed about. And then what will they think? Feeling. Oh, right. But how many do we have? I mean, I do not pretend to be able to read people's minds. And you can think, well, and you might be thinking now, well, this is the Ajahn Amaro saying he can't read people's minds, thoughts, but I know that he really can because he has to say that in public because he's a monk and they can't claim psychic powers. But he really does know what's going on inside my mind, feeling. And even though he just said that, I'm sure he really can. Well, that's the even though he said that, I'm sure he really can feeling. You know, it's everything the mind creates. You just see, oh, it's just these are just attributes of the citta arising, ceasing. They're not self. And then the Mara comes in and says, "Ah, oh, come on, you can't get away with that." No, these are. There's some real issues here that are definitely you and yours. And I know you have never told anybody about them, but you know, and you're not going to sneak out of it that way just by calling them mind states. Well, that's the you're not going to sneak out of it just by calling them mind states feeling. So this really pisses Mara off to an extraordinary degree. He is not happy. And so that then there. But that even the mind throwing up those doubts and complaints and accusations of you're not being you can't just drop this issue, this problem because it's your responsibility to be identified with it. Don't think you can get away with that. You have to be punished. I say, well, thank you for sharing. But this too, even though that might be true, even though that might be true, you're not negating the content, but you are saying, well, yes, this content may have validity. Yes, in the objective world, there may be something to this. However, that comment, you can't just wriggle out of it like that. That is actually just another mind state. Yes, because if you negate the content and say and push that away and try and wipe it out, then that slips easily into vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of. But we can say with wholeheartedness, yes, well, it may be I am. Maybe there is something that's trying to wriggle out of something else. But the fact is that in this moment, this is a thought, this is a feeling. It's like this. It arises, it ceases. And then the doubting mind says, "Yeah, but it's true, it's true, it's true, it's true. I really am bad. I really am bad. I'm lazy and stupid, and nobody loves me." Well, maybe so, but actually, the spluttering mind that's trying to affirm that and assert it, that is just the sound of the spluttering mind. It's a feeling, self-criticism. It's a pattern of thought. It arises, it ceases. It doesn't have an owner. So this whole manner of approach is like stepping outside the content of encrusted attitudes, passing thoughts, changing moods that are either just arriving because of the weather or their deeply rooted habits or whether they're dense or medium or light or whatever their nature might be. It's noticing what it is. This is an attitude, this is a feeling. Pleasant, painful, neutral. Being mindful of that, this is an attitude. This is not a guaranteed accurate readout of the way the universe actually is. This is an attitude. This is a feeling. This is a thought. To consciously withdrawing the attention from the content and seeing what the nature of the process. This is a thought, a feeling. It arises, it ceases. That's all. When there's true mindfulness, when the mind is fully aware, heartfully aware of this kind of process, then what naturally occurs, at least what I find, is there's a letting go, there's a loosening. It's no longer unconsciously being regarded as as an assessment of reality, but it's seen as a construct, as a created form. Then there is necessarily a letting go. It's like when you see the trick, when you see how the conjurer does the trick, then you can't unsee that. The trick can still be performed again in front of your eyes, but something in us knows how it's done. Oh, that's the trick. Aha. Something has shifted in the way that that's apprehended. Something in us can't be fooled in quite the same way, to quite the same degree. The heart has changed. There's a liberation. Those seemingly solid walls, solid attributes of who and what we are, they've been seen as not being solid. It's like if we've been in the dark for weeks or months, years on end, even if the light just switches on for a moment, in that moment of seeing, we know the shape of the room. We know what the darkness contains. We know, and we can't unknow that. We can get distracted from it, or we can lose sight of the implications of it. But there in our heart, we know. Something in us now knows, so we can't be pulled in the same way. Now, I don't usually put a lot of store in dreams that we have. Usually, when people ask about dreams, or what did the Buddha say about dreams, the answer is usually very little. But he does talk about some significant dreams that he had, particularly some prior to his enlightenment, just before the enlightenment. And I usually say that maybe once or twice a year we'll have a dream that has definitely got some kind of symbolic value and there's a clear message. And the rest of the other 364 days of the year, it's just the debris of the day. I was just saying to some people at tea time how just this morning I had this very vivid dream about which involved a whole mass of black gunk. I was ill with something or other, and this whole mass of black gunk was being extracted from my head by some kind of doctorish being. This mass of black gunk was emerging, and then in amongst the black gunk, then this doctor said, "Oh, look at this! Ah, this was probably what was causing the trouble, and it was a miniature human skeleton." And you could see a tiny little thing, and you could see the skull with the teeth are kind of a little bit prominent, sort of buck teeth, and it was sitting on the skeleton of some other animal. You could see kind of bits of flesh on the bones and everything. So I woke up this morning and thought, what the hell was that about? So most of the time we don't get a clear readout, but sometimes we do. Sometimes, every so often, once in a while, there's a clear readout. And I'd forgotten about this, actually, until someone reminded me about it from reading a letter that I had written last year. And this was on the morning after we had arrived at the ancient Amaravati in Andhra Pradesh in India. It's on the south eastern coast of India. And the Amaravati in England, Ajahn Sumedho's monastery, is named after this. And in ancient times, it was a great capital city and a center of Buddhist practice and teachings. And there was a huge, glorious stupa there, which is now just a sort of mound with a few ragged stumps of pillars dotted around it. Anyway, we had arrived in the village of, which is now a very humble little village, on the Krishna River. But then the night that we had arrived there, then I had this very powerful, very, very clear dream. And at the end of the dream, the denouement of the dream was I was after this various travels and things going on, I ended up in front of this wall, And on this wall, in 2 foot high, clear white letters, was written a sentence. You know how sometimes when in a dream you're trying to read something and the words sort of move around in front of you, and that you can't quite pin down what things are saying? That's what happens often in my dreams. But in this one, it was very clear and very vivid, and it stayed. There was this arch, it was like an arc of words across this wall, and the letters were about 2 foot high, brilliant white letters. And the sentence was, "Life beyond desire is unaffected. Life beyond desire is unaffected." And that's not a phrase that I have any knowledge of ever having read anywhere before, or I'd ever thought of. It's not a phrase that I'm familiar with. But having arrived in the Amaravati means the deathless realm. So, and also I lived at Amaravati in England for about 10 years and have very close associations with it. And also my own name, Amaro, means deathless, so there's a connection there on that account. So, and again, I hesitate to read too much into dreams, but it was rather like, message, get this. And so I reflected on that a lot. Life beyond desire is unaffected. So when we think of a word like unaffected in English, we tend to think of that as being sort of numb or neutral or somehow inert. A situation it's got a quality of deadness to it. But in Pali, the word unaffected is anatta with one T, not anatta, but anatta, A-N-A-T-A. Also means you can translate it as uninclined, that which is not leaning towards things. The unaffected is a synonym for nibbana, for ultimate reality, the unaffected. And it was kind of intriguing that such a term had arisen in the dream world, when I never think of that or don't use that. When I'm either explaining things or just contemplating them on my own, it's not a term that I would use very much. But in a sense, it was embodying that quality of where the heart abides when it looks out upon the world with mindfulness, with real satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom. When we say the heart is in the deathless realm, if you like, when the deathless realm has been realized, there's that looking out upon the world of the body, of feelings, moods, thoughts, ideas. There is that kind of clarity. There's the heart is unaffected in terms of, oh, this is the isn't this incredible? Everybody loves me. This is great. People all around me are praising me. This is great. I love this feeling. This is, oh my God, I'm falling apart. I'm a hopeless fraud and everyone hates me feeling. Oh, this is the everything is good, everything is bad, everything is really mundane feeling. It's that spaciousness, the infinite spaciousness of heart, whereby all those successes and failures, gains and losses, praises and criticisms, happinesses and unhappinesses, the space within which they all take shape, do their thing, proclaim their truth, and then dissolve. It's the space from which that is viewed. Or if we like to use the analogy, since we were by the Krishna River at that time, the other shore. Like standing on the shore, which is safe and peaceful, and looking onto the shore of the other side of the river, which is dangerous and fraught and filled with confusion. It's that quality of security. When we talk about refuge, it's the same kind of quality, that there is that in that safe place. And so when we use a term like unaffected, it's not a kind of dead or immobile quality. It's simply referring to that that incorruptibility, that security, that state of our, that quality of our own nature, which is incorruptible, imperturbable, which nothing can be added to it, nothing can be lost from it. It is utterly full and complete and pure in its own right, free from birth, free from death, untied to the limitations of self or time. Another aspect, though, of the because sometimes in dreams also things have layers of meaning or different qualities. And as I was pondering that sentence, you know, life beyond desire, when the heart has really let go of desire, what is life like when it's not driven by desire to get to have pleasure, desire to become, desire to get rid of, that it's free from tanha of all kinds. That the English word unaffected doesn't mean just to say that things don't affect it, but also there's the usage of the word in terms of affectations, being affected, being sort of putting on airs or taking refuge in performance. And being one who is somewhat prone to performing and acting in affected ways, and as one very memorable phrase, actually she was using it about herself, this very lovely woman who was the school matron at an all boys public school in England, a boarding school, which is very, very high pressure and achievement oriented school called the Haberdashers School. They get 60 or 70 pupils into Oxford and Cambridge every year, and people send their boys there so that that will happen. So there's a lot of crises and breakups, and this woman was the school matron, and she was this real heart of gold. She was completely non-academic type. She was like the mother for all of these harassed boys, and the school chaplain, who was the one who'd invited us to visit, you know, really treasured her. And she was a real, you know, London Cockney, because the Haberdasher School used to be, it was like a Jewish boarding school in the East End of London originally. And it had moved out to the country near to Amravati Monastery. And she said, yeah, I don't know why they like me. I mean, I'm all mouth and makeup. But, you know, people seem to want to have me around. And that phrase, all mouth and makeup, stuck in my mind. And so sometimes one of my favorite self-deprecations is that I have the kind of an all mouth and makeup personality, so that, you know, I can put on a performance, but a lot of it can just be superficial, and the mouth will go for hours with almost no causation whatsoever. Seeing that it's already 9:18. Hardly warmed up to my theme yet. Haven't even got to my first point. Don't worry, I'm just joking. But this reflection on affected, you know, that life beyond desire is unaffected. That the Dhamma is just what it is. It doesn't have any affectations. It's not presenting itself as, it doesn't need to promote itself or dress itself up to be other than it is. It doesn't need to promise more than what it is. And that when the heart is really attuned to Dhamma, then there is that freedom from affectation, of feeling like you've got to, or you want to appear to others in a particular way so that they will see you like that. I will be like this so that other people, when they see me, they will feel that I am like this and this and this. That's a heck of a structure to be carrying around, like one of those sort of, when you've got On your fingertip, you've got a chair with a frying pan, and then a carving knife all balanced on top of each other. Yeah. It's a very wobbly structure to hold up. So that life beyond desire is unaffected. That when the heart attuned to Dhamma, then there's no need to carry around or support affectations. You just do what you do and let the world make of it what it will. Because, you know, you can't really make the world, you know, them. Also, I like to contemplate who them is. They who have all these feelings about us. You know, when we care about what will people think? What will they think? And I often wonder, who are they? Who is this mysterious they who are having all these thoughts about me and you and everybody else? That rather than trying to project into that and invest a lot in that, just the Dhamma can't be fooled, and the Dhamma doesn't need to be dressed up in any way. It is naturally inviting. Ehi pasiko, it invites us to come and see. It is just what it is. And that the more the heart is attuned to Dhamma, then we just trust. There's a faith to do what we do, and then let the world make of it what it will. You know, some of them will like, some of them will dislike, some of them will be neutral, and then their feelings will change. and those that like will dislike or be neutral, and vice versa. But if our hearts, our actions, our speech is attuned to Dhamma, then we can have faith. We can trust that things are as in accord with goodness, with truth, with what is going to be useful, as much as possible. And that's the best that we can do with our lives. And that we then support the qualities of peacefulness and clarity within ourselves as much as possible, and then are intrinsically offering that to the world around us, to support that in others around us, into the bargain. So I offer these thoughts for consideration.